Hello, welcome to Illinois Radio Reader. This is Lisa with the News Gazette dated June 17th, it's a Wednesday, 2026. Today on the front page of the News Gazette is a colorful picture of four happy-looking young ladies holding up their track shoes. It's a large picture, and it under the heading says, "Now that the high school track and field season has ended, area state champions are listed here from left to right. We have Addison, Assistant Parks Addison Luck, Danville Samantha Brown, and Jemiah Esther, and Muhammad Seymour's Madeline Marks as they kick up their feet and enjoy the moment. The four IHSA titleists joined fellow News Gazette All Area Girls Track and Field first teamers in our newsroom for portraits, interviews, and radio spots. Five more All Area teams will visit this month as we celebrate the area's best and brightest from the spring sports season." At the top of the front page, we will switch over to an article that is not so positive about our area youth. And this one is entitled, "Tragic for Everyone," from the Champaign Police. A 16-year-old is city's fifth gun fatality so far this year. 17-year-old in critical condition, by Luke Taylor. The year-to-date homicide count in Champaign rose to five as a 16-year-old was pronounced dead following a Monday night shooting. Of those victims, only one was over the age of 20. This is different from our past gun violence issues in that both the shooters and the victims are younger and younger, State's Attorney Julia Reitz told the News Gazette on Tuesday. "We used to be focused on 20-somethings, whereas now it's teenagers. Not only that," she said, "but the firearms involved have higher magazine capacities and accessories like laser sights or switches that make guns operate as automatics." Little information has been made available to the public regarding Monday's incident at this time, but police say one victim was pronounced dead, while another, a 17-year-old, is in critical but stable condition at a hospital. Champaign police were dispatched to the intersection of North McKinley Avenue and Paula Drive at around 9:31 p.m. Monday for a report of a shooting. They initially found the 17-year-old boy and then were informed of a possible second victim nearby. They found the 16-year-old in the 1500 block of North McKinley Avenue, about half a block north of where the first victim had been located. Police remained near the scene for several hours and are continuing to look for potential witnesses, evidence, and video footage that could aid in the investigation. No arrests have been made at this time. Reed said it's always a question of where youth are getting not only firearms but sufficient ammunition for larger magazines. "Generally," she said, "these are not random shootings. There are relationships of some kind, often involving ongoing feuds and retaliation attempts between shooters and victims. One challenge police continue to face in these situations is obtaining evidence from witnesses who are hesitant to come forth or provide accurate information for a variety of reasons." Reitz also said the Safety Act should not be credited for any kind of shift in violent crime. "There are always ways to work within the limits of the legislation to prevent the public from violent crime," she said. Conversely, she gets frustrated at demands for prosecutors to throw the book at the defendants. "Our American system of criminal justice was created to protect the individuals from the power of the government," Reed said. "It's not a book that I can throw at people. That applies additionally to juvenile cases in which priority is always for young people to be able to be rehabilitated and to move forward with their lives." She described her emotions, seeing these ongoing cases as including frustration, concern, anger, and certainly sadness. "It is tragic for everyone, and we're not alone. This is not unique to Champaign-Urbana or Champaign County," she said. "This is an issue that crosses the state, crosses the country. We have to work with our neighbors and our partners to address this. One thing more people in the community could do to help would be to come forward about who has illegal guns and where they're coming from," she said. "There have been 38 shooting incidents in Champaign so far this year, resulting in 19 individuals being struck by gunfire. All 5 homicides that have occurred in Champaign in 2026, this year, were committed by gunfire. By the end of June 2025, there have been 40 shooting incidents since the beginning of that year, and 4 individuals have been killed by gunfire. In 2021, a major year for gun violence in Champaign, there were 135 shooting incidents by the end of June. And our last article, here on the front page from the Urbana City Council, with the heading, Aldermen Set to Vote on Fate of Civic Center. Some aim to reconcile a preservation push with MTD's proposal, by Jana Wiersema. Supporters and critics alike will have to wait until next week to see if the City Council approves a historic landmark designation for the former Urbana Civic Center, which has been closed since 2018. However, if Monday's Committee of the Whole meeting is any indication, the request could fail as aldermen weigh the case for preservation against plans for a proposed bus transfer station at the site and try to determine whether the two goals are mutually exclusive. Alderman Verdell Jones III said that as an Urbana native who attended many events at the Civic Center, the venue holds a special place in his heart. If you would have asked me this 10 years ago, I would have fought tooth and nail to keep it, he said. But the fact of the matter is, we recently have all had the opportunity to go in and inspect it inside thoroughly. It is not in good condition, and really it's just collecting dust and wasting money. He also feels that the bus transfer station is a great opportunity for the community and downtown. Let's not try to make it difficult for a thing that we need, Jones said. Alderman Cherise Hersey, James Quisenberry, and Mary Alice Wu also expressed doubts about whether the building could be reused. Though they did indicate interest in having the Civic Center's history recognized in some way, City Council members voted to put the landmark application on the regular agenda for June 22nd with no recommendation. Wu made the motion after City Attorney Matt Rochely advised that final action on the request, whether it ends up being approved or denied, would need to happen at a regular council meeting and not in committee of the whole. The one nay vote against the motion to send forward with no recommendation came from Alderman Chris Evans. He believes that it is possible to landmark the Civic Center while still making the transfer station, which he agrees is needed, work at the same time. Nobody is talking about landmarking the Civic Center and trying to return it to an event center from 1982, okay? Evans said. We're talking about incorporating the Civic Center in a brand new way to be part of a transit center, either as a lobby, and if you look at the student drawings at the University of Illinois architecture class, the possibilities are endless. U of I students previously presented concepts for how the center could be incorporated into the MTD's project as part of an academic assignment. Local preservation advocates Phyllis Winters-Williams submitted the landmark application for the building, which is located at 108 East Water Street. The Civic Center was opened in 1970 and was designed by Smith, Seton, and Olock within the context of regional modernist expression and holds significance due to its architecture, integrity, recognizability, and contributions to the civic and social history of the city of Urbana. The Historic Preservation Commission stated in its positive recommendation to the council, if a building is designated as a local historic landmark, any exterior renovations that affect its architectural character would require a certificate of appropriateness or economic hardship from the city per the zoning ordinance. The landmark request comes as the Champaign-Urbana Mass Transit District hopes to buy the property from the city and build a bus transfer station at the site. While the district has worked in partnership with the city of Urbana for more than 15 years to find a viable downtown transfer location, decisions regarding the Civic Center property directly affect MTD's ability to advance this project at 108 East Water Street. MTD Managing Director Carl Gannett wrote in a letter to the council. He said in a previous interview that keeping the Civic Center building would impede vehicle circulation on the site. though some members of the Historic Preservation Commission suggested that there are ways to make it work and urged the MTD to consider adaptive reuse of the building. The MTD board voted in late May to commit a 20% local match in its potential application for a Federal Transit Administration grant for the transfer station project. The project cost is currently estimated at $32 million, which would put the local match at $6.4 million, MTD External Affairs Director Ashley McLaughlin said at that time. Gannett wrote in his letter to the council that no matter what happens with the landmark request, the MTD will still be committed to improving transit access in downtown Urbana. But the landmark decision will affect whether the transit district applies for the FTA grant. MTD will not pursue funding for projects that depend on conditions outside of its control that may prevent implementation, he said. Applying for and receiving federal funds without the ability to implement a project, one, creates compliance and oversight risks under federal grant programs, and two, affects how the district is evaluated in future federal reviews, and three, undermines the credibility of the agency as a grant recipient. Community Development Director and Zoning Administrator Olivia Jovine told the City Council that she's curious about all potential options, but found in her research that the city has received very little interest in this site, except from the MTD. She acknowledged that the city hasn't put out a request for proposals. There's a lot of unknowns here, she said, but I think what I would have to say at this moment is that we need to consider the options that are presented to us currently, and I personally am not in the business of gambling a $32 million investment in our city. I've toured the building, Quisenberry later said. It is not a modern facility for hosting events. The walls, the main structure, does seem solid, but the kitchen and the bathrooms, they have not been maintained. They are all in need of maintenance. We've gone 8 years and nobody has been knocking on our door either to ask us to reopen it or to use it in a different way. Public Works Director Vince Gustafson and Public Facilities Supervisor Troy Richmond said at the Commission's May 6th meeting that deferred maintenance costs for the Civic Center were estimated at $750,000 to $1 million as of 2018. The figures include roof replacement, water heater replacement, HVAC replacement, updating electric service panels, lighting upgrades, stove and range hood replacement, sound system replacement, replacing tables and chairs for 300 guests, curtain replacement, general remodeling of the front office, conference space, restrooms, and kitchen, and periodic professional deep cleaning. The Historic Preservation Commission does not state that the building's best or only use is what it was used for most recently, Commission Chair Angela Urban wrote in an email to the News Gazette. Considering it for adaptive reuse could mean many of those interior upgrades and quite likely the building's annex, which contains the kitchen and bathroom, become unnecessary in the developer's plans. The city's capital improvement plan for the fiscal years 27 to 2031 includes an allocation of $700,000 for demolition of the Civic Center and environmental remediation of the site. Alderman Grace Wilkins said she'd like to see the MTD and the Historic Preservation Commission work together to find a mutually beneficial outcome, no matter how the landmark decision turns out. I would really like to find a compromise in between demolishing it completely and having an MTD downtown terminal that's really important to be a lost opportunity, she said. In discussing the building's limitations, Wilkins said it's her understanding from a building tour that simply removing the kitchen annex wouldn't be possible because that's where all the HVAC and electrical stuff is routed through. During the time for public comment, several individuals spoke in favor of the landmarking, though there were also a few who expressed opposition. Statewide Nonprofit Landmarks Illinois was among those who called for approval. Supporting local landmark designation and prioritizing protection of the building will ensure that there is not an irreversible loss of community heritage, the organization wrote in a letter to the City Council. The Urbana Civic Center is a very distinctive example of mid-century modern civic architecture in Illinois. Its pyramidal roof forms, strong modernist design, and prominent presence in downtown have made it an established and familiar structure for more than 50 years. Let's continue on with an article in Section A5 under Capital Coverage. This year, we're talking about Pritzker signing nearly $56 billion budget. It contains minimal spending increase despite being the largest in state history. By Ben Slalinski. And there's a picture here of Governor J.B. Pritzker signing the fiscal year 2027 budget alongside top state lawmakers Tuesday during a ceremony in Chicago. Governor J.B. Pritzker signed the eighth budget of his tenure on Tuesday as he and Illinois Democrats gear up for an election year battle centered around affordability, though he had to issue a cleanup veto aimed at addressing late-night drafting errors. The fiscal year 2027 spending and corresponding revenue plans that will take effect on July 1st total $55.9 billion, which is slightly less than what Pritzker initially proposed in February, though that's about $900 million more than what lawmakers initially approved for fiscal year 2026. Discretionary spending will be largely flat year over year after lawmakers approved supplemental spending for the current year. The fiscal year 27 budget raises hundreds of millions in new taxes, however, focusing on businesses, social media, fantasy sports, and digital assets. Despite calls from progressive lawmakers to more aggressively increase taxes on businesses and the ultra-wealthy, which largely did not materialize, the budget passed with relative ease in both chambers around 4 a.m. on June 1, and all Republicans voting against it, and just a few dissenting Democrats. In a year marked by economic uncertainty, rising costs, and unprecedented fiscal challenges created by Donald Trump and the MAGA Congress, Illinois has once again demonstrated that responsible governing and balanced budget go hand in hand with making life more affordable for working families and investing in the future, Pritzker said. Though the budget contains fewer bells and whistles than might have been expected in an election year plan designed to attract voters, Pritzker said Democrats' spending priorities stand in sharp contrast to Republicans' initiatives at the federal level. In Washington, they continue to run massive deficits and pile debt onto future generations to fund tax breaks for the corporations, brutal ICE occupations, vanity projects like a new White House ballroom, painting the reflecting pool blue, which already is an epic fail, and holding UFC matches on the White House lawn, Pritzker said. Illinois lawmakers included some tax breaks in the budget. It pushes the 1.3-cent gas tax increase that was scheduled for July 1st back until after the election to January 1st. It also reduces the sales tax on school supplies from 6.25% to 1.25% between August of 7 to the 16th. Lieutenant Governor Juliana Stratton, who is running her own race for U.S. Senate, compared those breaks to Trump's comment last week that he loves the inflation. She said Illinois budget should be a model for other states. We have never lost sight of your family's budget, Stratton said. From groceries to gas to health care, everything is more expensive right now, and families in every corner of our state are feeling the squeeze and letting us know it's getting harder and harder to make ends meet. Pritzker also reminded voters he took office in 2019, shortly after a two-year budget impasse, during which many state services were depleted, preempting criticism from Republicans that spending has grown significantly under his tenure. Pritzker argued, it has grown slower. And then the rate of inflation and the federal budget. It is worth pausing to reflect on just how far we've come in Illinois, he said. 7.5 years ago, our state faced an entirely different reality. House Republican leader Tony McCombie, a Republican from Savannah, said new taxes in the budget contradict Pritzker's message. Governor Pritzker can't campaign on affordability, then govern through tax hikes, she said in a statement. By signing this budget, he chose to put more spending and more pressure on family budgets instead of pursuing property tax relief, energy affordability, and economic growth. Pritzker issued what are known as item and reduction vetoes on the budget, reducing or eliminating erroneous line items such as removing $500 billion for an NAACP branch and cutting $60 million for a youth employment program to $30. Maggie Doherty of Capital News, Illinois, wrote that. Excuse me, this article is chopped a little bit. $60 million for youth employment program to $30 million. That were apparently included inadvertently. The thousands of pages of budget legislation came to fruition in the final 24 hours of the spring session before its early morning passage. The bill can take effect despite the vetoes because the state constitution gives the governor the authority to alter line items. Lawmakers could overturn the reductions, though Pritzker said he made the move in consultation with them. Majority Leader Robin Gabel and Senator L.G. Sims Jr., the House and Senate sponsors, respectively, of the bill, have identified a number of individual appropriation lines included in the enrolled bill sent to me for consideration that either contain errors or are duplicative of other appropriation lines already contained in the bill, Pritzker said in his veto message. Upon review, I concur with their assessment. Democrats approved hundreds of millions of dollars in new revenue through new taxes on social media companies, businesses, digital asset sales, and fantasy sports. Social media companies would be taxed on a progressive scale, starting with platforms with $100,000 to $499, users paying 10 cents per month for each user, all the way up to platforms with at least 1 million users, paying a $165,000 fee plus 50 cents per each user each month. Though a similar tax in Chicago is being challenged in court, the state still expects to collect $200 million in revenue from the tax Pritzker proposed in February. Pritzker said he's confident it'll survive legal scrutiny. Lawmakers also granted Pritzker's request to lower the cap on corporate net operating loss deductions for businesses, which would generate about $300 million in new revenue. A new 0.2% tax on digital asset sales will take effect January 1st and raise $60 million for the state. Lawmakers also established a licensing process for fantasy sports operators. Each business granted a license will pay a 15% tax on receipts from fantasy contests. The state is expected to receive $5 million from it, but participants in the leagues themselves will not be taxed. Sports bets made on prediction markets will also be taxed, starting at 1.75%. Remote tobacco retailers will have to collect taxes from the sale of cigars, pipe tobacco, and alternative nicotine products to Illinois customers. That's expected to generate $3.8 million. There's another new tax that lawmakers aren't planning to collect this year. The revenue package creates a targeted advertising service tax, more commonly known as a digital ad tax. It would be a 10% tax on providers of digital ad services on revenue from those ads over $1 million. Lawmakers expected it will face legal challenges, but its inclusion in the budget satisfies progressives who demand more aggressive taxes on businesses. Business organizations, however, are worried that small businesses will be hit hardest by paying a tax on revenue derived from digital ads, as those ads account for the bulk of their marketing. Lawmakers also decoupled Illinois tax code from the federal code and will now require individuals who sell small business stocks within 5 years of buying it to pay taxes on their gains. The budget itself does not eliminate tax incentives for data centers, but Pritzker has directed the Department of Commerce and Economic Opportunity to pause processing those requests at the beginning of fiscal year 27. It's not clear how much will save the state. The budget also sweeps dollars from several funds to boost spending, including diverting $150 million in sales tax revenue from motor fuel to the General Revenue Fund once public transportation is fully funded. Let's head over now to Section A8 under the Opinions and read an opinion article by our J. Mark Powell in his Holy Cow History. Well, guys, today we have a quiz. So get ready. Get your pencils out. I'm going to try to read the answers after each question. So here we go. How well do you know the president's dads? I think this is in anticipation of Father's Day. And he says every president had one. Some were wealthy, some were poor. Some were soldiers, preachers, tavern keepers, and even Hollywood moguls. How much do you know about the men who raised America's presidents? Okay, here we go. Question number one. Which president had the wealthiest father? A. George W. Bush. B. Franklin D. Roosevelt. C. John F. Kennedy. D. Donald Trump. Those are your possible answers. What do you think? I'll give you a second. The answer is C. Joseph P. Kennedy was one of the 20 wealthiest men in America in his prime. Banker, broker, movie mogul, but not, as he's often called, a bootlegger. Rather than smuggling illegal booze, Kennedy used his political connections to secure exclusive U.S. distribution rights for major British spirits, just as Prohibition was ending. All right, question number two. Which president was born after his father died? A. James Garfield. B. Bill Clinton. C. Gerald Ford. D. Barack Obama. And the answer is B. William Jefferson Blythe Jr. died in a car accident 3 months before Bill Clinton was born. The future president was raised by Roger Clinton, whose surname he legally took as a teenager. All right, question number three. Which president's father was the youngest when his future president's son was born? A. Theodore Roosevelt. B. Warren G. Harding. C. Kennedy. D. Obama. And the answer is B. George Tryon Harding was a young 22-year-old farmer and Civil War veteran in Blooming Grove, Ohio, when his son and future president Warren G. was born. Oddly, the G doesn't stand for George, but Gamaliel. Go figure. All right, question number four. Where is it? Question number four. Which president's father was the oldest when his son was born? Now we're going to the oldest. Was it A. John Tyler, B. Franklin Delano Roosevelt, C. James Madison, or D. Dwight D. Eisenhower? Which was the oldest father when the president was born? James Roosevelt was 53 years old when Franklin was born. James was a 52-year-old widower when he met 26-year-old Sarah Delano, the same age as his son Rosie from his first marriage. Question number five. Which president was the last whose father fought in the American Revolution? A. James Buchanan, B. Andrew Jackson, C. Franklin Pierce, or D. Abraham Lincoln? Answer. Benjamin Pierce served in the Continental Army and fought at Bunker Hill. His son also served as a brigadier general in the Mexican-American War before becoming president. Question number 6. George Tryon Harding lived to see his son Warren become president and also die in office. Only one other president was survived by his father. Who was he? A. Lincoln, B. Franklin Roosevelt, C. Kennedy, D. Ronald Reagan? Which of those? And the answer is Joseph P. Kennedy Sr. suffered the fate of seeing 4 of his children die. 2 of them, John and Bobby, were killed by assassins. Question 7. Which president's dad was a professional cheesemaker? A. Jimmy Carter, B. Herbert Hoover, D. Calvin Coolidge, C. Calvin Coolidge, or D. Richard Nixon? The answer is C. John Coolidge was a farmer, the most common career of president's fathers. However, he was also a true jack-of-all-trades, blacksmith, bricklayer, wheelwright, and yes, cheesemaker. He founded the Plymouth, Vermont Cheese Factory in 1890. And finally, question number 8. This president's father was a Baptist minister, though it appears to have had little effect on his son's public behavior. A. Chester, B. Chester Arthur, B. Andrew Jackson, C. Clinton, or D. Lyndon B. Johnson? Answer A. Although William Arthur was a Baptist minister who preached abstinence, his son was a member of the corrupt GOP political machine that ran New York and a bon vivant known for his love of wine, women, whiskey, and cigars. So that was Chester Arthur. Okay. That's our little quiz for today, guys.